Hello, welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. I'm Carla Nappi, your host. I recently spoke with Tom Mullaney about his book Coming to Terms with the Nation, Ethnic Classification in Modern China, that came out in 2011 with the University of California Press. Now, I'll keep this short so we can get right to the interview, but sort of just to let you know that our conversation was very much inspired by the nature of the book itself, which is both a study of a very focused moment in the history of modern China, in the history of kind of construction of ideas of and ways of categorizing ethnicity, but also it's a model of and really a call for wide reading. It's an example of the kind of work that can result when but you sort of leave yourself open early on in the research process and then throughout to inspiration from a number of different sources, including bookstores, including sort of the color and the title of a book on a shelf, including works that seem like they have nothing to do with what you're studying, and especially work that seems like it has nothing to do with your focus. It was a really wonderfully fun conversation, as I am sure you'll see. It's a great book, and I hope you enjoy. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Carla. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you so much for making time to talk with us today about your new book.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure.
So for listeners out there, we're here today to talk with Tom Mullaney about his recent book, and it's a really excellent book called Coming to Terms with the Nation, Ethnic Classification in Modern China. And that came out with University of California Press in 2011. Now, this is a book that's become, I think, very widely discussed. It's a very important book in not just the field of Chinese studies, but also in ethnicity studies and histories of social science. It's very elegantly written for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read it. It's very concise, which is really nice. You've clearly taken a lot of time to think about each word that you're using. And as a reader, that's really appreciated. And it's also just a very carefully developed study, and I learned quite a lot from it. So thank you so much, Tom.
Oh, well, thank you for saying all those kind things.
No, it's true. That's one of the great things about this job is that I get to pick the things that I get to read. So it's totally my pleasure. So, Tom, could you start us off by saying just a little bit about your background? Sort of how did you come to work on China?
Oh, sure. It was a very circuitous path basically, I arrived at the study of China through the study of language. I think that my original intention was to pursue linguistics before I knew what linguistics was. And I grew up in the East Coast, and I went to a very small school that offered two living languages and two classical languages. So I studied French and Latin, and I pursued those for a long time. And when I went to college, I went to Johns Hopkins for undergrad, and I was blown away by the fact that 20 some odd different languages were available and for instruction. And I just, I felt like a kid in a candy store, and I was planning on studying three or four at a time. And I had this ambitious plan laid out, to study Arabic and Russian and a number of other languages. And long story short, Chinese kind of came into focus, and I kind of stumbled into a class as a first year, as a freshman, and my instructor, who still teaches there, was just absolutely pure dynamite, an incredible instructor, really energetic and charismatic. And I kind of just never got around to my big plan, and I just stuck with the study of Chinese throughout undergrad. And then when it came time to decide at the end of that, where am I going to go? What am I going to do? History arrived by way of, I think, my family's influence. My parents are history buffs, and the discussions of 20th century history are a constant feature of basically every dinner. And so I think that, I knew I wanted to go to grad school. And basically I was taking my disciplinary passion of history and my linguistic passion with Chinese and bringing them together. And I think that probably shows up in all the work that I've done thus far, because it all has to do in certain ways with language. And on the other sense of I consider myself an historian first, and then an historian of China second. And I think that that has been a major influence. So yeah, I really had no enduring interest or fascination with Asia growing up, but it was really just through just an absolute fascination with human language in general. I just think it's where it's at. I wish I could study every language, you know, be fluent in every language. It's, I mean, I still have this boyhood dream of that, and it never quite left.
It's so interesting. I think we got into this field for very similar reasons. It's really fun to listen to. It's also really, I just talked with Tim Brooke about his recent book, and it's becoming so interesting how so many of the people that are interviewed on this channel cite teachers as being formative. Marta Hansen cited a language teacher also as being formative in getting her into the field. So this is a brief note of appreciation for all you teachers out there, because you're really helping shape the field, I think, in ways that aren't always obvious.
I wish we could applaud, but I don't think Skype can handle the variations in sound. But yeah, the major applause to all language teachers out there and high school teachers out there.
Absolutely. We can do a little woohoo.
That's right. Woohoo.
So this is actually, it makes a lot of sense that you came to work on a project that's very much about language and linguistics, given what you just described. But I'll just kind of put it out there. How did you come to work on this particular project and focus on the idea of ethnicity and ethnic classification in modern China?
I think in a broad kind of circumstantial sense, I went through catalysts, I guess, was a trip to Yunnan during my first trip to China as a junior at Johns Hopkins, and I think I went through the kind of realization, this very basic realization that every first time. Well, I think that most, if not every first-time traveler to Southwest China undergoes that hasn't had any exposure to China, which is an introduction to diversity, this realization, which is really inculcated by tour guides in China, this idea that, oh, you may not have known how diverse of a country we are, but in fact, we are home to such and such number. At that point, I wasn't paying attention to the number, such and such number of different ethnic groups, and traveling through the various hotspots, these travel hotspots in Yunnan. And I was, I have since returned and reflected on my first realization. But at the time, they had me, you know, I was captive to the narrative and really surprised and so forth. And I think I carried that with me, that there was something about this region which had surprised me or somehow made an impression on my mind. But ironically, the other thing that happened during that very same trip in 1998 was I'm a coffee person. I love tea and I respect tea, but I'm very much a coffee person. My first job was as a barista in a cafe, and so during that trip, I was always on the lookout for a good cup of coffee. And we traveled all the major metropolitan areas in this whirlwind tour. And the first place that had a really great cup of coffee was in Yunnan. And I thought to myself, this must be because of tourism. This must be because of the influence, very contemporary influence of backpacker culture and that. But later on, as I kind of dug into superficially began to expose myself to the history of Yunnan and the history of Kunming, the second startling fact came into play, which was that this was a city that throughout its history is closer to South Asia and closer to Southeast Asia than it is to Beijing. It was the site of this complex multinational site of urban site during the Second World War. It was just this very kind of inland international place that we typically think of when we think of Shanghai or Tianjin or Beijing. But here was Kunming as this other metropole in China that had this very complex history. And so I think I kind of carried those, both of those silly minor realizations in my mind for a long time. And when I was a first year at Columbia University, you know, I really dove in. I was like many first years. I was, okay, what's my project going to be? What am I interested in? And I basically just sort of checked out every single book I could find. You know, this prodigious literature on anthropology of ethnicity, anthropology of China and the Southwest, and started to pour through it. And I think that, and I always tell my students when they're this exact same thing is that when you are reading, when you're doing that initial reading of a broad literature, there's two types of readings you really need to do. You need to read the books and you need to read yourself reading the books. And so when I was doing that, when I was kind of watching myself or paying attention to myself as I read these books, it was very clear that there was this one thing, this one event that everyone was citing at in the introduction of the book, of their various books about the Southwest, that was just like lighting me up. And it was the classification project. You know, this sort of, there was this project at this point in time by which the groups that we are going to be discussing and contesting were formed categorically. And then we move on into the anthropology and of the region. And I just found myself saying, you know, what was this? What is this about? I sort of set out on a search to find an answer to these questions. And I mean, kind of long story short, at that point, it became this road. I sent an email to my advisor, Maddie Zellin, and I said, has anyone really done the classification? She asked around and wrote back a nice email saying no, and I think that'd be great. Not to my knowledge, and I think that would be great. And so it, you know, I was very fortunate to in my first semester of my first year to stumble upon this thing that really for some reason lit me up, and then it took me another 2 years to figure out why it was lighting me up, and that's another story. But it took me a year and a half to figure out what I really was studying was categorization and classification more than identity. But that was a very confusing journey because I thought I was studying ethnicity per se or identity per se. And it took me a good year and a lot of accidents to figure out that I was studying identification rather mm-hmm. than identity itself. And that was very exciting.
Actually, since we're here, can you talk a little bit about that journey, about that process of like what led you to figure out that that's actually what you were working on?
I think that, that was another moment. I was in this bookstore just by Columbia with a good friend of mine who now is off teaching, Ted McCormick, and we were in a bookstore together and just, you know, wandering through and looking around. And Ted picked up this book called Sorting Things Out, Classification and Its Consequences by Jeff Bowker and Lee Starr. And, you know, he just kind of picked it up and kind of flipped it around and looked through it. And he showed it to me. I seem to remember that he was gonna buy it, but he didn't know. I think he wanted to buy another book or something like that. And I said, if I remember correctly, well, let me know, because if you don't buy it, I'm gonna go ahead and get it. So he did the chivalrous thing and let me get this book because there was only one copy left. I got it, and that was the beginning of basically it was a mind blowing experience because it was like reading a text, you know. So this is a comparative study of classification regimes in different national and cultural and infrastructural settings that takes classification itself as the object of analysis. And to read that, it just hit me all at once without any ambiguity that, you know, oh my word, this is what I am studying. And this is why I've been, for this year, kind of spinning my wheels a little bit in terms of theorizing my project, because I'm not going the route of an anthropology of the Southwest. I'm not doing an historical ethnography of the Southwest. I'm not doing these things. And when I read this book, it hit me that I was you know, that that classification was going to be and identification processes were going to be the focus of the research. And then everything opened up. Literally, I mean, it just from that point on, it was kind of a 3-year blur to the end of my PhD program of just, you know, nonstop realizations, attempts, mistakes, successes, and finally, a dissertation, and then onto a major reorganization, but then onto the book itself.
Oh, that's great. I mean, and that really emphasizes the importance of wide reading and serendipity. I mean, so much of graduate training, as funding gets tougher and tougher to come by and it gets more and more compressed, it's so much about pre-professionalization. And I think one of the things that can get lost is the importance of, you know, a wide reading and just kind of exploration of things that don't seem to have on the surface anything to do with your research, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've often daydreamed. I have a friend, here in San Francisco, my friend Matt Gleason, who works at City Lights bookstore, and I was talking with him one time about my ideal bookstore, if I ever owned a bookstore, I think that it would be wonderful for the readers, for customers, to organize the bookstore on shelves that have to do with the central problem or the central problematic of the book, not its cookbooks, history books, sociology books, these broad designations, but, you know, books that are whose central problem is what is the possibility of an authentic existence. And all of those books would be in one section. And then all the books that are obsessed with a kind of question about death and afterlife would be in another section. Another one would be obsessed with, you know, books, whether they be fiction, children's books, whatever they are, all of the ones that are obsessed with kind of sociality and social relations and power would be in another section. And it would just make realization so much more possible in a sense. I mean, I'm sure it would come at its own costs. It would ruin other forms of serendipity. But yeah, just like you say, there are the realizations, I think, come from outside. The theoretical or thematic realizations often come from outside your designated section of the bookstore.
So some listener out there who has the means to start a bookstore, this is a request to you.
Yeah,
to make that happen.
And the bookstore should be called "What's Your Problem?"
And it should have an online version. What's your problem? Perfect. Oh, I love it. I'm writing that down.
Yeah.
So, Tom, you mentioned that this actually started as graduate research and as dissertation research. For listeners out there who may be in the process of working on doctoral research themselves, or maybe working on the final stages of a dissertation, or even turning the dissertation into a manuscript, can you talk a little bit for us about that process for you of turning this from a dissertation into a book?
Sure. Well, I think that there are different situations, not an infinite number, but more than one situation that an author finds him or herself in at the end of the dissertation, and that really determines what the revision process will be. So, for example, an example that wasn't my situation, but is equally common is, you know, the magnum opus 1,200-page or 900-page dissertation. And then the kind of central question for the revision process is what to cut, and should this be two projects? And I think so that's a whole set of questions that I don't have firsthand knowledge of, but that's like kind of one avenue that I think is out there. Another avenue which is out there, which is I've produced this dissertation. It stands alone well, but there is this nagging sense that maybe one more body chapter is out there that needs to be fashioned, and that will require that I have to go back into the archives for that question. So, like, the first one is the cutting question. The second one is the adding question, and then the funding question. How do I get the funding to go back to the archive to continue this? And then a third one is the one that I found myself in, which was a question of, I guess, structural organization. So the way that the dissertation was organized was in a sort of pure chronology, where the classification project itself, as such, doesn't show up until the middle of the dissertation, because obviously I'm working through materials from well, also British materials, but late Qing, kind of turn of the century into the Republican period, and then finally we get to the classification project in 1954. So it came at that place, and then I was reflecting on that with a mind towards the book, and I realized that when people read this, they're not going to be reading this, and I for a history of Chinese ethnology, because that has been maybe not completely covered. It has been very systematically covered, and I'm not reproducing that history. And the same goes for communist ethnopolitics. You know, these sort of the kind of Pekingology of the national question in China, and that has also been somewhat systematically addressed. And so the question became, like, what is my book going to be read for? And it was very clear that if anyone reads this book, within the field of Chinese history or ethnology or anthropology, it's going to be about the classification. And so what I did was I took that chapter that was exclusively about classification, and I kind of exploded it and distributed it. I'm Skyping out here into each of the chapters, such that in essence, and you saw this, it's kind of like an episodic treatment of the classification, where each chapter begins with a particular episode or moment of the classification. Those episodes are handled chronologically when you read across the book, but each of them launches back into a kind of a deeper history, whether it be towards the turn of the century or the 20s and 30s or wherever, you know, we need to go to answer and contextualize that particular episode. And that became, you know, a kind of narrative strategy to figure out, to try to really make this book about what this book really is about, which is the classification. And that is funny. That all happened. I received funding, or I used my research funding early right after I joined Stanford, and went back to the UK to go back to some of the British archives I was using. And it was like a 15, you know, whatever the hour flight was. And it was on that flight that I just sort of cut up and reorganized the whole dissertation. It was a very caffeinated process. I fall into this third category of a kind of the reorganizational question, as opposed to cutting or massively expanding the project.
Thank you so much. Now, it's actually the question of organization or the issue of structure is a perfect segue into talking about the book itself. Now, the book, each chapter of the book opens with at least one epigram. And these are quotations that speak very clearly and very deeply to the content of the chapter. But the book itself also opens with an sort of a master opening epigram. And that's a quotation by Saussure. Can you talk a little bit about both why you chose this particular quotation by Saussure to motivate the whole book, and also how you came up with that way of structuring the chapters, where you did choose to open each with a sort of organizational quote or set of quotations?
Sure. Yeah, no, I love it. The there was a recent review of the book that was the first to ask the question about the epigram of the book, and I
really?
Yeah, I really appreciate it. I haven't had a chance to reflect on it. No one has asked me until this review, until you, so it's very exciting. I think that the way that you know, sort of to confess, I and this is reflective of the way I work more broadly, is that the book had taken shape, and it had, you know, it really already existed. And then I kind of went back into my notes, or back into, I took a book off the shelf and was looking at my various marginalia. And one of the book I took off was A Course in General Linguistics. And I stumbled back across this quote that, or maybe I'd written it on a note card and I'd lost it, and I came across the note card. And I think what happened was I was suddenly in a position to realize that this is what the book was about the whole time. So really, it wasn't a guide so much as a, maybe it was an invisible guide or an unspoken guide. And then I came back across it and realized that this is what it is about. But about the passage itself, well, there's a few dimensions of it. There is, you know, as you know, and as listeners will know, there is a very impassioned discussion of the relationship of the written and vocal sign of writing and of literary and oral and dimensions of language within Saussure, and this was at the most basic level. This was reminded me or reflected back to me what people like Henry Rodoff Davies and these other amateur ethnographers, and then these professional Chinese linguists and ethnographers, and what historical linguists across the world were doing around this time, which was they were materializing in the form of transcriptions on pieces of paper in their, you know, various notes and then proceedings, an oral world into a written sign that was always already connected to an observing language, this transcription language and these sorts of things. And then they were using the written signs quite literally to then in their centers of calculation to find and discern what they saw as organizing logics and deeper invisible structures of social life of the whole world, in terms of, in their case, ethnic groups or ethnic communities or nations or whatever they were calling them. And kind of following this quote here, you know, they, at some level, they did believe that, to follow the quote, that in order to find out what a person looks like, it is better to study his photograph than his face. You know, this written sign that has been materialized in according to and with the help of a particular technology, and then to stare at that inscription and to manipulate and compare and contrast those inscriptions in order to figure out who someone really is. So within that passage, what a person looks like is very kind of connected to identity and so forth. And there is a dimension of the whole classification project, but more broadly, the way in which ethnic identity, national identity was being, was one of the major ways in which it was being thought of, this idea of language as identity or language as a great way of getting at identity, is a process whereby, you know, as the quote goes, the written word usurps the principal role. Representations of this more hard to pin down, fluid kind of social reality is that the role of that is usurped by representations thereof that become manipulable and analyzable and repeatable and so forth. And I think that it just on the overall passage, it just kind of captured for me what happened in China, what happened in South Asia, what happened in Africa, what happened with the Bureau of American Ethnology in the United States, what happens much in the Soviet Union, not to say that it was all based on linguistic classification, but it was always based on one or another set of markers that were used, these materialized, inscribed markers that were used as the basis by which we are going to organize this otherwise unorganizable reality out there. And it just sort of jumped off the page at me, And so I decided just to put it down and hope that someone would take notice.
Thank you. That is a perfect quotation, actually, I think, to open and to motivate the book. And you just mentioned the importance of organization, and it sort of makes me think of the sort of how often we tend to study the kinds of things that mirror our own interests, right, and our own personalities. And the book is both about classification as a form of knowledge making and identity on some level, and also your own, the structure of the book and your own methodology kind of reflects that. There's a very, at least in my reading of it, there's a very prominent element of this book that's about organization and classification and structuring based on mathematics. I mean, there's always, you know, five examples of something or three mm-hmm. reasons why something happens or two reasons. And it's really interesting to see how that organic sensibility really infuses both the content that you're studying, but also the way that you're writing it. And it works very organically. As part of that sort of mathematical or organizational and mathematical kind of element of the book, one of the things that you talk about in the introduction is the idea that China is a plural singularity. And this becomes more and more important as we work through the book and sort of culminates in the final chapters. But can you talk a little bit for us about what you mean by this idea of a plural singularity and how that kind of shapes the way you think about China and this book?
Sure. Well, I think there's I think within the plural singularity, the concept of plural singularity, there's a few different registers at which it's interesting to discuss. I mean, one is situated very squarely within the story of in this case, 20th century China. I mean, plural singularity is a political program. It is part of the political program of different regimes at different times to say that this is what China is, and it has to do. These regimes have to do a lot of work, economic work, political work, symbolic work to convince themselves and the broader citizenry that this is how we should think of China. And I think that's the sort of most basic level. But I think there's a broader historical level and an analytical level that is also at play here, which is the concept of representation itself, which is obviously fundamental to any modern governmental structure where an X number of people is representing or is supposedly speaking on behalf of Y number of people, whatever that relationship be, where Y is significantly greater than X. So you're like how that we are going to, the concept that it is possible for a plurality to be treated as a singularity, such that it becomes legitimate for a significantly smaller number of people, even one person, to stand in on behalf of that and speak on behalf of that plurality, I think is kind of this irresolvable but necessary dimension of any democratic process, republicanism, any sort of modern governmentality. And I think that this is being struggled with in a particular way in the 20th century Chinese case. And then there's another dimension from the history of social sciences, which is kind of very similar. I mean, social sciences is the estranged and then kind of cousin or nephew of the state. And that almost rejoins the family in this very powerful way in the period that I'm talking about here. And in its own way, it too is dealing with this necessary but irresolvably self-contradiction of plural singularity. So I'm going to use one person or two people or three cases or however many I'm going to do to stand in on behalf of this far larger collectivity that I'm thinking of as a collectivity. So this singularity is sufficiently representative of this plurality, and so therefore I'm really thinking of it as a as a plural singularity, that one person can stand in on behalf of the Lolo, one person can stand in on behalf of the Miao. And you know, this is simultaneously something that the social sciences and government, modern governmentality depends upon. It requires this type of compression and this way of seeing. And at the same time, it is one of the things that instantly invites a sort of like existential doubt that such a thing is even a legitimate way to see the world. It invites in a skepticism. It invites in the natural question of, is this a collectivity? Is this representation sound and reliable? And I really like that in the sense I not like it as a, I'm glad that it exists in the world, but I like it as an historical problem, because something that I tried to do in the book was resist this tendency and this kind of undertow that I felt the entire time that I was writing the book and thinking about the book and having conversations about the book, that what some people really wanted me to do was find the smoking gun and prove that there are more than 56 Minzu in China, or that there are really 52, or really there's 80. And to point out, like I did in a number of sections in the book, that the representations that were being created were really at odds with the way people saw their own life and their own worlds, and to resist the urge to make this a very simple story about kind of a haha, I found out that there are really 88 or 70 or whatnot, and to step back from this and to try, and I don't think that the book succeeds in this, but it hopefully kind of advances the conversation, that what this is about is identifying this irresolvable contradiction that is just a constant presence, not just in modern Chinese governmentality, but in modern governmentality and its relationship to the social sciences practically everywhere in the world. And to say that the story, in a sense, that I would want to tell would be exactly the same if we were talking about 58 or 40 or 100, that at some level there is something deeply troubling about the idea of plural singularities. Just inside this concept itself, there is this doubt and this problem, really, that there is no way around. And just to expand a little bit, I'm really glad. I think that you're totally right. Like that, my own orientation towards taxonomy is very evident in my writing in this book. And I think you're totally right. I mean, I think that I come to this project in a sense out of a curiosity and almost an obsession with taxonomy itself and just my own thinking. And also what's interesting is that there is a certain anxiety in this book. There's a certain nervousness about the way that I write this book. And I think it was very reflective of the kind of positionality of being a grad student that has to really thoroughly document every step of the way and take sort of small steps towards this destination, but making sure not to leap and bound in such a way that would invite a kind of critical intervention. And in a certain way, it's analogous to the type of furious paranoid documentation of taxonomists themselves that I'm studying. They are, you know, they are really trying, as much as I critique a number of them, they are in this paranoid way taking down the sort of minutiae of detail to try to embed their taxonomies in kind of safe nests that hold them and will support them. So in a sense, I think that your reading of it, the sort of symptomatic reading of it is right on. And that's sort of two answers in one. But I did want a chance to commend you for noticing.
Oh no, I think it's great, and it's something that I think all of us do on some level, right? Is we sort of look for the kinds of things that speak to our inherent sensibilities and sort of how we think and what we're interested in. And you're mentioning actually of the documentation of these taxonomists is actually fortuitous, because it's just that documentation that allows you to actually get into this very rich account. And you talk in this opening chapter, in this introduction, about the centrality to your work of five bodies of sources that really you identify here as really formative in the project. And so this is the text of the 1953 and 54 census registers, a collection of recently, at the time of publication, declassified reports from the 1954 ethnic classification project, the Republican era periodicals reading room at Sichuan University, the unpublished materials of Henry Rudolph Davies, who we'll talk about soon, and a series of oral history interviews. Can you talk a little bit about these sources? And you don't have to necessarily be comprehensive, but which of these kinds of sources were you most excited about? Or were there moments in working with them that really shocked you or surprised you or excited you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It would be very hard. I think probably if I had to say which sources were the most exciting or the most, it was the relationship between the census reports, the classification reports, and the oral history interviews, because they addressed the exact same time period, so they were already temporally in conversation with one another, but then they were quite literally in conversation with one another, because they made me aware of a body of information and from their perspective data, and also a network by which this data was being transmitted within this small community of demographers and the classification team itself. And what it allowed me to, what that body of material together allowed me to do, was to come to find a side door, a kind of unmarked side door through which I could enter and not get like the real story or, you know, okay, now I can just simply watch and see what this was all really about, but a side door that that would allow me to watch the kind of early micro historical processes by which the magic number 56 Minzu is being created. And what I try to make the case in the introduction to the book that situated where we are now, living as the descendants of this and kind of within the broader aquarium of the idea of 56, is that it is difficult, arguably to impossible, to use the present condition to reverse engineer or historically or kind of go back and historically reconstruct the formation of 56, because, you know, before I found these sources, the not only had the historical narratives been in not completely, but so thoroughly retrofitted to this 56 Minzu paradigm. Like everything you read either is a proponent of it or critiquing it or questioning it or arguing it. But also the source material by which any alternative narrative would be possible is, for reasons of availability, just not there. Like we couldn't see the decision-making process of 56. It became, you know, became really, really difficult. And when I found the census reports and the classification reports, it's just this window into a time just before the beginning of this sort of ontological and epistemological closure, where suddenly you see people talking about this such and such Minzu and such and such Minzu and such and such Minzu and such and such Minzu that now don't exist as such, and they're not qualifying their phrase, their sentences, they're not hemming and hawing about it. And there is no politically sanctioned paradigm yet. So there's a kind of moment of both flexibility, but also possibility, meaning this was also a moment in the early 50s when the story could have turned out very, very differently. And so what these sources do on the most basic level is allow just for the possibility of watching some of the central players in this story, kind of figure things out and work things out and talk about them very directly without the filter, the 56 means you filter that would later be enforced. And the second thing is that the particular relationship between the census and the classification reports and also the oral history interviews, allowed me to take this, again, this bigger question of ethnic identity and ethnicity and so forth, which I had already realized I wanted to look at through the lens of classification and identification. And it allowed me to take this and situate it into a question of, let's look at this from the perspective of the ethnic classification team and what confronted them, the problem that confronted them, the time period they had to work in, the tools that they had in their toolbox, the way that they saw the world. And we can follow them through this process of, you know, what are they looking at? They're looking at the census materials from 1953 in their unvarnished kind of, again, unfiltered way. Unfiltered meaning they haven't been filtered through the 56 means you paradigm that they have now. If you now go and try to recover the 1953-54 census materials, it has all been recategorized according to the 56 Minzu. So it's totally anachronistic. So if we look at this data in the form that they would have been looking at it, suddenly the story makes a whole lot more sense about what they're doing and why they were doing what they were doing and why they were relying upon the structures that they were and so forth and so on. So basically those three sources spoke to each other in a way that opened up this kind of moment that we really didn't know anything about and that we really needed to know about if we were going to make larger claims about what the classification was, what it meant, and so forth and so on. The oral history interviews in particular and were just incredible because, I mean, by virtue of the fact that I wanted to look at the, you know, really do a micro history of the classification, watch this very small number of kind of mid-level, some advanced, some senior-level social scientists and their students undertake this massively important politically and massively complex project, is I also wanted to know, when did they get their hair cut? Did they ever get headaches? What was the day like? And I was really quite in a sense kind of academically blessed by working and listening to people narrate these, interviewee in particular narrate these very human stories about, you know, the kind of hour by hour process, by which, you know, this person who was 21 years old or about that old at the time went through this experience, and that allowed me to reflect upon and feel more confident about approaching this as a sort of micro history that allowed me to get into a bigger history. And the other dimension of that, just very quickly, is that one of the interviewees that I worked with was a prodigious note taker, just like a incredibly detailed note taker about the various minutes of meetings and events and whatnot. And what was really amazing was to be able to go back and forth between speaking with him and reading through the transcripts and then back to the archives in Kunming and looking at these classification reports and kind of situating them side by side. And they were, although he didn't write these reports, so the notes and the reports are very separate. They are kind of mutually corroborating. So it allowed me to decide whether or not to trust these sources. And it also, because my oral history interviewee was paying attention to his own life at that time, it allowed me to really supplement and flesh out things that were not being, that were not in any way being talked about in the more sterile social scientific-y classification reports and vice versa. So it was just that those three in particular were just this, this incredibly illuminating kind of triangle of sources.
See, that's actually really, really interesting to hear, because it sounds like one of the things that was, that really helped you produce this story was being able to access the kind of dialogue between the inscription of the events that happened at the time the events were taking place, and then the memory of those events, and sort of finding some way to create a dialogue out of those two kinds of ways of getting at the past allows you to tell this really interesting story that wouldn't have been possible with one or the other on its own, right? That's super cool. So let's actually get into the story. So I'm going to move us forward a little bit, because I don't want us to be keeping you all day here. So let's actually get into what happened and what this story was. So in the first chapter, you do kind of at least two really important things here. You're both placing this story that you're telling, and actually the early communist period in general, in the context of this broader transition from the Qing and from an empire to a nation state. And you make, I think, a compelling argument for including the early communist period sort of in these broader narratives in a way that existing historiography perhaps hadn't done. And then you talk about these two really important aspects of what becomes important to the actual manifestation of the expedition in the ensuing chapters. And one is talking about the importance of Minzu to the communists in general, right? And especially in the context of the differences in the way that the Kuomintang and the communists actually dealt with the idea of Minzu. And then you bring us into this census, this first inaugural census, and the importance of the fact that the communists are actually leaving open, right, and leaving sort of completely open-ended the ethnonyms that the census takers are actually producing themselves to describe their own ethnicity. So can you talk with us a little bit about these two kinds of things, or whichever one you find most interesting, both this broader issue of ethnicity in this history of the conflict between the communists and the KMT, and also the importance of this open-endedness of the census itself?
Sure. Maybe if I can organize it through the second part of the question, and then move towards the first part. I appreciate you for emphasizing that, because it's a part of the first chapter that, from my own reading and in writing it, I thought of as being, and I still think of as being, very, very important, and something that in the conversations I've had and the reviews I've seen kind of consistently slips through, in a sense that I don't think, maybe I didn't emphasize it enough, or maybe people disagree or don't see it the way I do. But I really think that the way that this first census was taken out undertaken with regard to this Minzu identity is really fascinating. The story, I mean, it was widely known, this idea that the first census gave rise or emerged out of this huge collection of names. But what it tends to be treated as is a kind of the snapshot into the real situation, that there really are, that's the importance of this first census, is that it tells us that there really were and maybe are far more than 56 Minzu, and that, so that's the important part of this moment in the story, because once we arrive at 56, we can see that that's a compression, and therefore we kind of have our story and have our contours. I think from one perspective, that's very, very true, because in the population statistics that I give from the first census, the self-categorization census, is we come across very large self-identified groups that no longer exist as independent, or were not classified as independent Minzu. And so I think in from the perspective of those, when we look at those groups, like the Pula, for example, 103, the self-identified Pula with 103,000, or the Tamyao with 2,178, and these sorts of communities, there is a lot of reason to believe that this means that there was a self-conscious, self-identified group. That, you know, we'd have to dig into it, but there's a lot of reason to believe that, yes, some sort of community was identifying and petitioning, and that it was compressed or amalgamated into another category. But the part that I tried to emphasize, which I think is equally important, is this notion of that what they were experimenting with at this time, almost unbeknownst to them, was something that, except for the episode that comes out of Ben Anderson's foreword, which I didn't actually know about until I read the foreword, which was fun, is that so there's one other example of this, but a census in which the very definition of identity is left to the respondent at some level, and that this has been this is not something that we see in census taking practices in the modern period at all, really. I mean, if we think of it in the broad scope of things, where not only is the respondent able to say, you know, what Minzu am I, but is really able, as it turned out, to say, what Minzu am I and what do I mean by Minzu at the same time, and that there was something that the results of that and its complete incompatibility with the necessities of the forthcoming National People's Congress, with not just that, but the kind of the way that the structure of the government was being put in place. Again, nothing, not really exceptionally, looked a lot like, in many ways, modern states elsewhere. Because of this incompatibility, that this radical experiment with self-identification collapses. It, in a sense, it cannot be allowed to exist, because not because of the communists, not because of Chinese communism, not because of anything in their political ideology, but because of because of its incompatibility with governmentality. And so, kind of harkening back to the point I made before about what one of the goals was in this book, is to say, this is not a Chinese communism story, in a sense of I call it the communist imposition hypothesis, to follow Foucault. It's like, it's not a story of this pristine, whether it be 400 communities that come out of the census and then a communist state that quashes them or subdivides them. This is a story about, to go back to the kind of Saussure epigram in the beginning, about a reality out there that encompasses states, encompasses capitalist economies, encompasses social sciences, that really has no choice, because of the way that it's built, to deal with markers of identity and these signs of identity, and not really kind of this the curving, swirling, unmanageable reality of social life. It cannot deal with that. And it can, and so it needs these types of economies. And so, one of the amazing things, I think, historically, as kind of an historical experiment, is that this first census, being one of the only in modern human history that affords respondents the ability to say not only what means they are, but what do I mean by what identity are you, but what do I mean by identity, and then watching it collapse, is that it alerts us to something much broader about the modern condition, and you know, this the fundamental and irresolvable ambiguity of what any one of these, you know, size one population, quote unquote, groups in the census, like, what are they? Like, I try to make the example of the character Xiang that shows up in the census, and I was writing about it, and then I just had to stop for a second and sit back and just say, I have no idea, and I cannot have any idea what this is. Like, is it the last of a tribe? Is it a mistake? Is it a joke? Is it a, and that the only reason that I'm able to sit back in my chair and have this kind of ambiguity is because of this accident, this kind of accident of history that the communists had attempted very naively in this act of self-categorization, where they really, I think, believed that people kind of knew who they were, quote unquote. That's one dimension of that first chapter that, you know, I'm hoping as I have more conversations about the book that will come out more in dialogue. Because I just think in a sense it's where it's at in that first chapter.
If you don't mind, why don't we kind of take this, because this is sort of, do you mind if we follow this through a little bit and
sure.
sort of use this as a thread, and we can come back to the communist KMT thing later if you want.
Sure.
But this is actually, I think this is a perfect way to bring us into what happens next, because it's really, this is a failure, right? That becomes incredibly productive. And it's really, you let us know here that it's really the failure of this early approach, this sort of open-ended approach to ethnicity that prompts the formation of this ethnic classification research team that goes on to become so important to the story that you're telling us. And the next chapter really, I think, emphasizes, it does a great job in emphasizing the agency of the ethnologists and the linguists in shaping the project, right? And sort of shaping what happens to this ethnic classification project, both in the field and then as it comes to shape ideas of ethnicity and the 56 today. Can you talk about, in this chapter, ethnicity as language, the importance of notions of language to these linguists in shaping ideas of ethnicity in this context? Because I think we take for granted today, right, that language is sort of fundamentally part of what defines an ethnic group in a lot of contexts. But one of the things that this chapter does so wonderfully is to show the emergence of that equation or the emergence of that relationship in this context.
I have to thank you for, it's really a delight I greatly appreciate you've chewed on my argument in a really nice way. And I really appreciate it because you're hitting on all the things that I hope come out. So I just want to thank you. I think that the point of this chapter, in a sense, was to denaturalize what you say, and I agree with you about this, about a naturalization of language as being fundamental to identity, a legitimate way to think of identity, a legitimate way to think of how people self-identify, obviously not everyone shares this kind of commonsensical attitude, but an immense number, I think, do. And I think that, from my view, because of this naturalization, this approach to ethnic identity kind of is let off the hook. It's let off the analytical hook in ways that other approaches to identity have not, such as physical anthropological biometric approaches to identity, which for very good reasons have been subjected to very thoroughgoing, very widespread, both political but also epistemological critique. And I think that, in fact, that linguistic approaches to ethnic identity are actually just as susceptible to the same level of analysis as these more overtly distasteful approaches to identity, but in fact, they really don't. I guess there's two things within this chapter that I tried to bring out, which is that the linguistics of the classification and its larger turn of the century Republican era genealogy is a very particular type of linguistics. It's not the linguistics that is taught in intro to linguistics in most universities now, and really since the 70s, 80s, 90s, after the kind of move towards sociolinguistics, away from historical diachronic linguistics, reconstruction and so forth, into sociolinguistics and whatnot. This is a linguistics of philologists and orientalists and about, these massive surveys of taking down transcriptions of various tribal words in different locations for mother, father, water, sky. That's the linguistics of this. And what's ironic about that? So it's a very particular theorization of language that enables this next step towards a very particular theorization of ethnic identity. If linguistics were to be used now as the surrogate for ethnic identity, ethnicity would look very, very different, in a sense. So that's the first part that I kind of tried to chart out a little bit. There's another dimension which is in the dissertation, and I just needed more. I need a lot more time to think about it, and so it didn't feature prominently in the book, but I'm happy to talk about it here. Is that there is a very deep connection between the linguistics that I'm talking about here and physical anthropology, race science, and biometrics. And you can see this in two ways. One of them is that the exact same people, including Davies, including people like Fei Xiaotong and Lin Yaohua in the Republican period, are in many, many cases saying, well, what we really need to do here in order to understand identity in this very confusing taxonomic and ethnological environment of the Southwest, what we really need to do is be out here measuring skulls and measuring heads and noses and ears and submitting the population to a kind of biometric analysis that alone would give us a true, the data we really need now. And they kind of continue. I'm expanding on shorter passages by them, but I think that this is a fair expansion. But that's too difficult to do. It's very intrusive. We don't have the manpower. It might be distasteful. It's just not feasible. And so the best second choice we have is language through this particular lens of historical linguistics. So the very same people who are advocating the use of language as surrogacy for ethnicity have in the back of their mind, many of them have in the back of their minds, a kind of race science approach, biometric approach to identity itself. And that is reflected very clearly, and this is the second point of it, in the way that they go about, again, their theorization of language. Their theorization of language and their methodology of linguistic analysis is basically the same as you would find in a physical anthropological study, meaning that they refer to the words as specimens. They're taking down specimens. They have identified through what will come to be known as the Swadesh list of key fundamental words, something which had already existed in comparative anatomy with the idea of the fundamental kind of monuments and features of the human skeletal system and muscles that provide the most reliable points of measurement if you want to measure human societies across the world. You really shouldn't measure soft tissue because soft tissue is pliant and therefore will confuse you when you use the calipers because you might squeeze too hard or squeeze too light and therefore error will be introduced in kind of prohibitively large degrees into your data. So therefore, we need to do the jaw to the top of the skull, these more reliable features. That is the Swadesh list. The Swadesh list is, we have to ask questions about mother and father and water and arm, not about, iPods and computers, and because all of these high-end words these high-level words tend to be the types of words that are imported from other societies and therefore, again, introduce error into it. So this is all to say that the way that they're approaching language and the way that you are supposed to record language, analyze language, is strikingly similar to comparative anatomy. And I've been trying to find a good avenue or venue to think this through. I didn't think it was appropriate for the book, but there has been I have seen, I feel like, this kind of narrative of the demise, or this triumphant narrative of a turn within the social sciences advanced by people like Franz Boas and others that really moved away from a race science approach to identity and towards something that is constructed and contingent and these sorts of things. And I guess just the most basic levels, I don't buy it. I think that race science did not die out, or biometric analysis didn't die out. In the story that I'm looking at, it dies into linguistic studies. But linguistic studies is exonerated of all of this baggage. It is let off the hook with regard to kind of political and critical and analytical criticism, because it's seen as being part of the good emic squishy part of identity that is real and true, unlike our bones and our skin and all of these sorts of things. It's in a sense collectively let off the hook, which then subtends and bolsters this triumphant story about how this move towards a cultural turn towards identity. And if you look at this, I don't know about other contexts as well, but if you look at this cultural turn in a number of other locations, it is heavily reliant upon a diachronic historical linguistic substructure, which itself bears the unmistakable signature of a kind of racialist comparative anatomist approach to identity, which means that it lives on in a certain sense. That's what I'm worried about.
I think actually that comes out, maybe not explicitly, but that's, I think the point, the underlying point that you're trying to make comes out really nicely in this chapter for two reasons. I mean, you're emphasizing here, in your account of Davies, right, and his own methodology and the way, and the reasons that he's taken up by these, Chinese scholars and ethnologists, you emphasize the importance of measurement, right? Both his own measurement and his instruments of measurement, and also the traces of that measurement or the diagrams, the way of, and visually, right? The way of organizing and conceptualizing those measurements as information visually in diagrams. And I think you make a really good point that that's, at least as I read it, one of the reasons that his work is taken up, right? And does move into this context and for the Chinese ethnographers. And you also, as part of that also, you emphasize the importance of direct observation, sort of measurements, and that also being an important component of his work that makes it translatable and usable by the ethnographers. And you also, and we won't get too much into this, but emphasize here that Yunnan becomes a kind of cultural laboratory. Which I thought was really interesting and really also allows your work to speak to the broader historiography of laboratory science in a really interesting way that I think helps undergird this larger point that you're trying to make, even if you don't explicitly, you know, make this point about racial science and the connection between that and linguistics.
That's very encouraging. I'm glad that part, it does feel present. That was a very challenging decision to figure out what to do with, and I'm still thinking through that, because I think at some point my next project and whatever comes next, I really would like to revisit these questions, and you know, after my thinking has matured.
Well, so I'm going to move just to, because again, I don't want to keep you, I would love to keep you all day talking about this, because this is fascinating. but I'll ask you, as a way of moving to the next stop, to the next chapter, about something that comes up as seemingly, you know, another really important conceptual move that you're making. And so that seems to me to be the way we're navigating the book. And I really love that. And so let's keep doing that. And the idea for me that came out in the next chapter, Plausible Communities, this is a chapter where you're following the scholars that we looked at and learned about in chapter two into the actual capital of Yunnan province, where they meet up with the other half of the ethnic classification team that they're working with. And you're talking here about, as I read it, or at least one of the important things here, is about the way that they navigated both this kind of the Stalin question, right? This idea of the Soviet definition of nationality or Nazia, but rather than slavishly following it, right, as you said, they actually use this as a way to very creatively think about ethnicity, not as a static formulation, but in terms of potential, potentiality and plausibility. So can you talk a little bit about that aspect of this chapter?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this. My hope is, in a sense, that this, that out of this chapter comes something that could be useful, in a sense. It could be useful for conceptualizing or thinking about how modern states are approaching and model the social science state nexus is approaching questions of governmentality in larger contexts. I suspect that the story that I'm trying to tell here is not unique to China. And I mean, if I had to boil it down, I think that the classification team are applied constructivists. They are they know full well that identity is constructed. They know that it in an odd sense, it's as if they were to if you were to take the sort of classic hits of history and philosophy of science and technology, STS literature, sociology of knowledge literature from the 70s onward, and to kind of send it back in a time machine and let the classification team read this, I feel like this is a silly way to frame this, but I feel like they would read it and go, "Of course,
right."
No crap. Like, knowledge is in this sense constructed. It is dependent upon this very complex sort of set of configurations, both political and material and subject. You know, exactly. And we're going to take this one step further. We are going to mobilize this to our. We're going to make use of this characteristic of expertise, knowledge, identity, and so forth, and we're going to mobilize it towards our end. So that's why I make the claim in the introduction that there's something insufficient in certain cases, and then kind of off the mark in other situations for us to imagine that if we critique the 56 means you paradigm by saying that, you know, it's not empirically correct, or that there are more than 56, or that there are less than 56, is a little bit off the mark, because the very people who are undertaking the classification project in the time they're undertaking it are very aware of this, and are actually working with this. They have gone to the next level, the kind of next meta level, and they're employing that level to their own ends, and that's this idea of identifying not communities that exist, but communities that could exist, and then to think of them along a kind of spectrum of, you know, fully existent, almost existent, possibly existent with a whole lot of work, and then possibly existent with more work than we are willing to commit, or more work than we can feasibly commit, in which case we're not going to treat them we're not going to actually categorize them as a minzu. And this comes out of the kind of immediate problem that they're facing. Like you point out, is the question of how to reconcile this with the politically mandated Stalinist definition of Nazia and therefore Minzu, as they're translating it. But they're using this as an opportunity to ask a set of questions and to lay out a strategy that is really, really complex and I don't think really has come to the fore that we've been aware of so much. And, you know, I was rereading Provincializing Europe and Chakrabarty and the critique of the kind of pre-national and historicism. And I mean, what the classification team is doing here is a sort of applied historicism. They're saying that, we are going to announce almost prematurely the Minzu identity of those that we are also internally and explicitly identifying as not yet Minzu at the same time. And then we're going to design the architecture of you know, Minzu Gongzuo, of nationality work, as a way to shape that spectrum of almost very close and fully Minzu groups. That's going to be the field of the political field, the economic field, the cultural field upon which and through which we are then going to operate for the next half century, however long it takes to kind of bring about the realization of this blueprint that we're doing. And the big irony of all of this, this does tie back to the communist Kuomintang or communist nationalist question, is that at the end of the day, really the end goals of these two political regimes are more alike than they are different. The goal is somehow towards a homogenization or an acculturation or a movement towards some sort of singularization. But the avenues, the kind of pathways that these two political regimes outline as the best way to get to this almost shared outcome are so strikingly different in many cases. Like, why I try to ask the question that, you know, has been asked many times before: why would a state, a communist state, that in its own professed orthodox approach to, or in its own professed orthodoxy, says that Minzu is an epiphenomenal kind of reverberation of the more real economic base and class base of reality? It is kind of, in a sense, a very, very long-lasting figment of our imagination. Well, how ironic is it that so much energy and time and political capital and symbolic capital would be put towards categorizing those figments of imagination, and celebrating those figments of imagination and so forth. So why do this? Why not simply deny it outright? And I think to answer that question, why theorize it so in such a sophisticated way, this sort of applied historicism? Why do these things? And I do think that the answer to that ultimately lies in, we have to take very seriously the kind of Marxist-Leninist discussion of the quote, you know, the so-called nationality question, that there can be, we've got this thing, we've got national identity, we have these, which is ultimately epiphenomenal, but we have to be very careful about how we deal with it, because it can be a progressive force. It can work towards a revolutionary condition that leads us to the goal we want, or it can act as a retroactive thing that takes us back, sets us back in time and leaves us with more ground to recover. And so we have to kind of shepherd this figment of imagination into its eventual disappearance. We have to shepherd it unto extinction, in a sense. And so from a certain very macro historical perspective, the Chinese communist state is providing its own answer to a much longer question that dates certainly back into the Qing, of how do we create a singularity out of this plurality, and into a stable configuration that will be stable, not just now, but not just in 10 years, but exhibits a increasing stabilization such that the more work we do, the longer this thing will last. And I think that the kind of Marxist-Leninist, Chinese communist approach to it is that we are actually going to invest a great deal of our energies and mobilize populations to a great deal along axes of Minzu identity, because in a sense, this is the best way to make sure that this national identity, this Minzu identity, this ethno-national identity doesn't get away from us and become a force that we have to confront rather than use as a tool. And we're going to build this immense and sophisticated and very messy and constantly breaking down infrastructure, but we're going to maintain it to the best of our abilities so that we can shepherd this idea unto its eventual extinction. In which case we have arrived back at that shared goal that is shared among, I think, communist and nationalist regimes, ironically.
Now, in some ways, this is actually a perfect place to wrap up. But of course, I'm not going to let us wrap up there because I can't let listeners go and I can't let you go unless I ask you a little bit more, just one more question about the next chapter. Because the next chapter that you give us, the consent of the categorized, and then we'll let you wrap up and go on and write your other books, which I can't wait to read. But this chapter is actually really, really wonderful and really central to the book. This is where you really lay out for us, not just sort of in practice, how these ethnicities and ethnic groups and ethnic concepts were actually constructed in action, but you also talk about then once these ethnic groups were constructed and construed, how the team decided what to call them. And this was done, as you show us really beautifully in this chapter, through a series of interviews. Right? And these interviews, as you describe here, there's so much interesting stuff going on there because there are these issues of how the participants are chosen and what motivates that. There's the issue of how language and sort of dialogue among the interviewees actually goes into not just constructing these ethnic groups, but also convincing the participants to adopt these self-definitions and these ethnic groups, and also talks a little bit about sort of how language and intelligibility are construed in this context. So can you talk to us a little bit about these interviews? What were they like? What's notable about them for you? And just kind of talk about this as part of the process.
Sure. Thank you. Chapter 4 picks up on the concept of ethnic potential that comes out of chapter 3, and this is the place where the reader, like us, we get to see this concept in action in the course of the classification, and also the place where the classification team members are first. I argue applying this concept of ethnic potential that they have in a sense derived and worked through back in their offices largely in Kunming. And so in the very basic sense of the project, they are interviewing members of different self-identified communities. And the important part of that, and that's the where the title of the book comes from, is that they need to assess the level of consent and if possible, build consensus in subtle ways from representatives as part of a larger process that both they know and that the communist state knows is going to have to happen for the categorization as a whole to work. So I make the argument that that this is really the first time in the history of Chinese ethnology where Chinese ethnologists, well, and also linguists, have to turn their notebooks around and show them, in a sense, metaphorically, to those who are being described in those notebooks. And at some level, saying, "Do you agree with this? Does this work? Does this jibe well with your sensibilities?" Because they know that without that, they're not going to be able to simply impose these identities. They're going to need the participation of these groups. So, but the what happens in the interviews themselves is that's really interesting is that the interviews are, in terms of the ones that I, all of the ones that I came across, were very subtly orchestrated with this idea of plausible communities, ethnic potential, with those concepts in mind. And so the pattern that I found was the based on linguistic evidence that, that the classification team already was already in possession of, they already had working hypotheses based on their own work. And then again, the longer running genealogy of Republican era Chinese ethnotaxonomic work, they had these working hypotheses about where they wanted to put who. And, you know, we already know we want to put self-identified groups A, B, C, and D into the E, for example. And so what they would do is they, in many cases, would have representatives of A, B, C, and D in the room at the same time as part of the same interview, and that that was actually part of the plan. And the plan in a number of cases that I saw was to kind of contrive a seemingly spontaneous interaction, contrived from the sense from the perspective of the classification team, and then seemingly spontaneous from the perspective of the interviewees, where they would be in the room with representatives of communities that they might not have much interaction with in everyday life. In some cases, no interaction at all, and that as part of the interview process, they would be asked about their lives, their social conditions, and also about their languages. And in certain cases, the interviewee actually kind of prompted or suggested or somehow created the condition where the different interviewees could speak in their own language, in their own dialect, and then out of that, come to realize, like, holy moly, I can understand this other person. And then I had no idea. Like, I mean, and so they would create a condition in which the interviewees would, you know, in a sense, come to realize, and I'm making scare quotes here, which can't be seen, but come to realize on their own what the linguists already knew based on their prior linguistic evidence, which is that all of these communities speak dialects of a single language. And so language was in a sense used again, this idea that language is such a natural part of identity. And we see it kind of, in a sense applied. It's that they would set up these contrived situations to create moments of mutual identification, surprise, shock, kind of curiosity, in among the interviewees. And then at those moments, or in that kind of fortuitous context, they would ask the interviewees, how do you feel about the prospect of being in the same minzu? How would you feel about that prospect? What's as important about this, and the response in a number of cases was positive, was affirmative, that and so the classification team member would write down, as they did in every single report like this, that there seems to be, there seems like there would be support for such an amalgamation. There would be a support for this type of categorization and this type of categorical merger. It wasn't always like that. We can get to that in a second. But equally important in this whole idea is, again, the idea that comes out of the first chapter, which was that to ask a community of this small group of people, what would you think about being the same minzu? Did not mean in 1954 what it means now. I don't think. I think that at this time, this term is still maybe familiar, may not be familiar, may never have been heard before, may have been heard before. And so if we try to ask ourselves, how would this term be translated? Do you want to be the same minzu? The way I thought about it is that it's like being asked, you know, how would you feel about being kind of almost federated or in some sort of collective, in a sense, not that how would you feel about having your identity crushed into a single identity and therefore and your identity erased from history? That question was not asked, even though that's what we know happens. And so I think that the way that these contrived these interviews were contrived and the kind of the place of this word Minzu at that time allowed for in certain cases the classification team to gather the initial consent of these representatives and to write down in their reports, yes, this is a plausible, we think that this is a plausible community. And that didn't always happen. And so in the epigram of chapter four, I quote a interviewee who very bluntly says, no way. Like, I know where you want to put me. I kind of know what you want to do. And what I'm here to tell you is that the community with whom you want to categorize my people, quote unquote, are not the same as this other community. And, you know, this doesn't make sense. In fact, we don't marry each other. We don't speak with each other. We are very different people. And then the second part of the epigram reveals this very blunt side of the classification team when it needed to be, this very epistemically violent part of the classification process, which wasn't all contrived and orchestrated and spontaneous. It was, as the passage says, this community, basically the representative of this community disagrees, but we still think that this is a plausible community. However, this will require, quote unquote, political persuasion work. If we think about this on the spectrum of plausible communities, this one is going to be harder, but we still think that we can do it. We just have to apply, in this case, like political force to do this. And so you see this, you kind of see this spectrum coming out, I hope, coming out of the chapter of people that in a sense, kind of go along with the contrived condition, and then those that oppose it very consciously and strongly. And we watch as the classification team reacts to both of these situations.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. As for listeners who haven't yet had the chance to read the book, there's a ton more material in here that we haven't had a chance to talk about. It's an extraordinarily rich study and lots more interesting stuff.
And it's in paperback now, so it's actually affordable.
That's yes. Yes, it just came out in paperback. Is there anything else about the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to point out for listeners who haven't yet had the opportunity to read it?
I think that probably we've covered a number of the books. Maybe if I could just emphasize that I really encourage listeners to dig through the bibliography and to, if inspired, to dig into some of these literatures outside of the China field. Because I think that in this case, it's kind of the science studies literature and history and philosophy, science technology literature and those SSK and many others. But I think there's an immense amount of theoretical and methodological perspectives and that are so rich and that we would benefit, that many of us would benefit from using or being aware of and contending with. But I think beyond that, the substance of the book owing to your wonderful questions and thorough reading, I think has come out, and I'm very appreciative for that.
Oh, it's like I said, it's completely my pleasure. I loved reading the book. And speaking of loving reading books that you produce, what's next for you? What are you working on now?
The next book is kind of continues in this question of language and taxonomy, but it takes it into a very different directions. I'm writing a history, 19th, 20th century history of the Chinese typewriter, using this history as a launching point into a broader discussion of the development of Chinese language, Chinese character-based information technologies from late movable type and the telegraph through the emergence of computing, and then in a sense using each of these technologies as launching points into larger questions about materiality, gender, transnational politics, Orientalism, Sino-Japanese relations, business history, military history, sort of a broader collection of themes and issues that are deeply connected with language, technology, mediation, and ultimately the kind of the big question that was asked during the 19th and 20th century, can Chinese characters, can Chinese writing be salvaged in our march towards modernity? And if so, what will this language look like, and how will it behave, and how will we relate to it in this new era? So it's kind of simultaneously a study of technology, but more importantly, it's this question of what has happened to Chinese writing in the last two centuries, in a much kind of broader set of questions about, again, about gender, the body, materiality, politics, epistemology, and a number of other factors. Yeah, it's called. I think I'm just gonna call it the Chinese Typewriter, A Global History, possibly Radical Machines, and then my favorite title so far is The Typing Rebellion.
Right.
So we'll see. We'll see. I think those little names will show in various places within the book, whatever it ends up being.
Well, thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you very much, Carla.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next time.